the headlines this hour. Iran's leader approves amnesty and commutation of sentences for a large number of people detained during recent riots in the country. China says it reserves the right to respond to U.S. moves to shoot down what Beijing says was a civilian unarmed airship off the coast of South Carolina. And the former Pakistani military ruler, General Pervez Musharraf, who came to power following a bloodless coup in 1999, dies at the age of 79. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution approves amnesty and commutation of sentences for a large number of people who were charged with or convicted of involvement in recent riots in the country. Ayatollah Khamenei issued the decree in response to a request by the head of Iran's judiciary. It comes on the occasion of the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Clemency will only apply to those who have not committed espionage, murder, the destruction of public property, and are not affiliated to foreign spy agencies. Ayatollah Khamenei also granted amnesty to a number of other people convicted of other crimes. Iran's foreign minister says U.S. bullying and sanctions policy are doomed to failure. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a meeting with his Cuban counterpart in Havana. Yeah. The top Iranian diplomat reaffirmed Tehran's condemnation of foreign meddling in Cuba's affairs and the U.S. role in the 2021 riots in the Caribbean country. Also referring to the recent unrest in Iran, Amir Abdollahian said the U.S. and some other Western states target sovereign countries by simultaneously imposing sanctions on them and provoking riots there. The Cuban foreign minister, for his part, also denounced unilateral sanctions and foreign interference. Bruno Rodriguez said enhancing ties with Iran is a priority for his country. Amir Abdollahian also earlier met with the Cuban president. He is on a foreign tour, which has already taken him to Mauritania, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Iran has denounced the UN nuclear watchdog over its Wednesday report that has raised concerns over changes to equipment at a nuclear site. Iran's nuclear chief, Mohammad Islami, says the IAEA report is based on a mistake by an inspector during a visit to the Fordo plant. Tehran has written to the agency explaining the inspector's mistake, but the agency publicized the issue. The Iranian official criticized the agency's behavior as unprofessional and unacceptable. Islami has warned that such practices would harm IAEA's reputation. The U.S. and its European allies have issued a joint statement accusing Iran of being inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They say that Tehran's response to the agency is inadequate. Author and journalist Robert Fantino joined us earlier with his take on IAEA anti-Iran allegations. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
It was the United States, as you said, that destroyed it. The United States that violated the JCPOA. Iran, as I've mentioned before, in previous conversations, remained fully compliant with the JCPOA for a full year after the United States reissued the sanctions. Iran was not under any obligation to do that. Once the agreement is violated by one party, then it's null and void, basically. But expecting that the other countries would continue trade and continue to support Iran, the Iranian government gave them a year to do so. And once they ceased doing that, the Iranian government rightly continued with its nuclear program once again. It's the United States that can't be trusted. It's the United States that has violated agreements continually. And it's the United States that should be sanctioned and should be held accountable for its violations of international law.
Iran's deputy foreign minister says the country is playing an increasingly important role in the international arena, as evidenced by its accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Iran joined Shanghai, which was Iran's demand. It was Iran's demand for many years. But the important point is, why was it admitted at this time? Our entry at this point showed the need for multilateralism, and this shows the position, role, and importance of Iran in global relations and also in the New World Order. The same is true about BRICS Plus. It is interesting to note that when the Islamic Republic of Iran proposed to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it took more than 15 years for the Islamic Republic of Iran to join the organization until it was approved. But when the Islamic Republic of Iran proposed to enter the BRICS Plus process until Mr. Raisi, the Honorable President of the Islamic Republic of Iran, at the BRICS Plus meeting held in China, gave a speech as a country that wants to enter this group, it didn't take more than 4 or 5 months.
In an interview with Press TV's Insight program, Baghdadi Ghani also said the world is witnessing the gradual rise of a new world order, and Iran can play an effective role in shaping it. The Iranian diplomat said the decline of Western powers is quite tangible, and it will become more and more evident as time goes by. Baghdadi Ghani said the world's emerging powers are setting up their own multilateral mechanisms, notably the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS. Tens of thousands of demonstrators have once again hit the streets in Tel Aviv to protest against the policies of the right-wing cabinet led by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The protesters chanted slogans against Netanyahu and carried banners and signs that read "A Cabinet of Shame" and "Bring Down the Dictator." Israelis have been protesting against the Netanyahu regime for the fifth straight week. Protesters are expressing their disapproval of what they call a fascist cabinet and its proposed reforms meant to increase political power. Netanyahu returned to power as the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. The cabinet is planning to hand over more powers to lawmakers in appointing judges and overriding the rulings of the regime's apex court. The coalition also intends to intensify the expansionist policy with more settlement units in the occupied West Bank. Tim Anderson is the director of the Sydney-based Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He tells us how politics are shaping the protests against Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet in Israel.
Look, I think it's important to recognize that the protests represent a very deep faction, a deep division that's occurring between the Zionist factions. This sometimes isn't recognized so much on the resistance side of things, but what they are calling an openly fascist faction led by Netanyahu has been in power in the colony for around 15 years now. And yet the liberal faction, which is more concerned about the image of Zionists and of the colony, dominate in the US, for example. And so there have been very important attacks on the Netanyahu regime and criticisms of Israel, which haven't been seen before, from a lot of North American Jews. So this conflict between the liberal Zionist faction, let's say, and the openly fascist faction, I think is quite important because it foreshadows a destabilization of the regime itself. The liberals would like to change the system. They're very upset at the apartheid brand, for example. That's why they talk about shame. They really have this dreamlike ideal of two states and being kind to the Arab population and so on. And of course, the openly fascist faction has completely destroyed that in the eyes of the world.
The United States says it has shot down what it calls a Chinese spy balloon that had been flying across America in the past week. The U.S. military said its fighter jets downed the balloon with a missile when it floated off the southeastern coast. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon was being used by China to surveil strategic sites in the continental United States. Chinese Foreign Ministry expressed strong dissatisfaction, saying that it was opposed to use of force to attack its airship. Beijing had previously said that the balloon was for civilian meteorological purposes, and that it had strayed into U.S. airspace. The incident brought a new low to already tense relations between the two sides. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, postponed his visit to China over the incident.
The balloon's journey across the ocean has gripped the world's attention. On Friday, the U.S. military said it mobilized fighter jets, but advised President Joe Biden against shooting the balloon out of the sky for fear debris could pose a safety threat. U.S. authorities said the military took custody of the balloon when it entered America's airspace. On Saturday, however, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon, which was being used by China in an attempt to surveil strategic sites in the continental United States, was brought down above U.S. territorial waters. The Pentagon also snapped what it called China's unacceptable violation. China has expressed regret, blaming winds for pushing what it calls civilian airship into U.S. airspace. Beijing said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. The incident prompted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to issue a personal note to his Chinese counterpart condemning Beijing's move.
China's decision to fly a surveillance balloon over the continental United States is both unacceptable and irresponsible. That's what this is about. It's a violation of our sovereignty. It's a violation of international law.
Blinken further added that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. Some White House allies say postponing Blinken's trip was an overreaction to the incident, particularly because U.S. officials have said that they do not think the balloon was able to gather information that cannot be acquired in other ways, such as spy satellites. In a phone call with his American counterpart, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China and the United States should handle occasional individual cases in a calm and professional manner. Wang stressed that China has always strictly abided by international laws and will not accept any groundless conjecture or hype. In the face of unexpected situations, what both sides should do is to maintain steadiness, communicate in time, avoid misjudgment, and manage differences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said it spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing.
The U.S. is already at loggerheads with China over a string of issues. That includes the rift between the two countries over Taiwan, the economic and trade war between Washington and Beijing, and China's anger over America's presence in the South China Sea. Will the flying of a Chinese balloon in the airspace of the U.S. further deteriorate the situation?
The U.S. allegation of a suspected spy balloon flying in the sky of Montana has added to concerns that the already heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing would further escalate. Although balloons are a powerful potential surveillance tool, it is odd that Beijing would do something this provocative just before a key U.S. diplomatic trip, especially since China has been pushing to repair relations with the United States post-pandemic. Some in the U.S. say it is very likely that China has been using this technique for a while and that the United States was aware of it, but diplomatically chose not to respond. A U.S. Defense Department spokesman confirmed that such intrusions have happened before, saying it is not the first time that you had a balloon of this nature cross over the continental United States. It has happened a handful of other times over the past few years, to include before this administration. Some believe that the United States is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China. Some others reason out that the tensions have flared up in recent years between the two, with Biden declaring that China is America's most consequential geopolitical challenge and competition between the two global superpowers is intense. After all, Washington and Beijing are already at loggerheads over a host of issues. That includes tensions over Taiwan. President Biden has antagonized top Chinese officials by saying on several occasions that the United States would defend Taiwan if China attacked a self-ruled island. One close ally of the administration said that although White House officials have walked back those statements, Biden is intentionally sending a message to China when he makes such pronouncements. But tensions between Washington and Beijing are not limited to that. The two powers have deep differences on other issues as well. The economic war between the United States and China, with the two countries having imposed tariffs on each other's goods, can be named as such. The U.S. presence in the South China Sea also adds to concerns that Washington and Beijing would be facing each other militarily. In the current situation, one small excuse would be enough for the whole world to wage another world war.
The former Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf has died at the age of 79 after prolonged illness. Musharraf died in the hospital in Dubai after spending years in self-imposed exile. The chiefs of Pakistan's army have expressed condolences on his death. Musharraf ruled for nearly a decade after seizing power in a coup in 1999. In 2008, the country's first democratic elections in 11 years were held, and Musharraf's party lost. Facing impeachment by parliament, he resigned and fled to London. Later in 2018, he returned to Pakistan to run for a seat in parliament, but was immediately disqualified. 6 years later, a court sentenced him to death in absentia for the 2007 imposition of emergency rule. The verdict was later overturned. Musharraf survived at least three assassination attempts. Our correspondent in Islamabad, Nasser Kazmi, tells us more about the life and political career of Pervez Musharraf and how he will be remembered.
If we will look into the politics of Pakistan, former President Pervez Musharraf, who died today in Dubai, will be remembered as one of the powerful and one of the controversial president of Pakistan, because when he came in power back in 1999 through a bloodless coup, when he overthrown the government of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and came the president and became the president of Pakistan. During his tenure, the controversies were on because Musharraf, as his opponents called him, the close ally of the United States, and this was the time when in 2001 Al-Qaeda waged a war on US, and then US waged a war on Afghanistan under the pretext of Al-Qaeda and Taliban linked militants. Musharraf was the head of Pakistan's, who gave them permission to carry out attacks inside Afghanistan and allegedly provided bases to the United States for carrying out attacks inside Afghanistan. So the controversies continues during his tenure when he was in power. He faced three attacks during his tenure.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Enemies engineered Iran's unrest meticulously, but failed due to wrong calculations. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of elegists, and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Aliha. I've written down a poem by Sa'ib Tabrizi so that I can read it for you. He said, "Even if you tell me you shall not see me, I'll not despair like Moses did. When Allah turned to Prophet Moses and said, 'You shall not see me,' Prophet Moses let it go. But in this poem, he says, 'I will not despair.' Even if you tell me, 'You shall not see me,' I'll not despair like Moses did. I know the sweet language of my love." Nice poem, but it's incorrect. He's implying that the Almighty God, God's divine being, is being coy when he says, "You shall not see me." No, "shall not see me" means you shall not see me. God doesn't exaggerate when he says something. The poem is very beautiful, but the meaning is incorrect. So we have two things here. One is good poem and the other is good meaning, good content. You need to keep all of this in mind. Having said that, I believe we have been holding these kinds of meetings for 40 years now. And when I look at these now, compared to previous years, the work that is being done is much more advanced and better in terms of the types of elegies and poetry that is recited. There is no doubt about this.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
However, I'd like to draw your attention to some matters. While this is a form of hybrid art, what you are doing is a form of hybrid art, and art is beauty. We know this from our religious text. Our religious texts, including the Quran, Nahjul Balagha, Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya, and many of our supplications. Regarding the Holy Quran, Imam Ali alayhi salam states, it has a wonderful appearance. Wonderful does not imply that it is just beautiful. It is stunningly beautiful. It has a wonderful appearance. That is how the Quran is. It is second to none in terms of its beauty and art. Almost all of the best Arabic poems, the sweetest and most beautiful and eloquent Arabic poems, belong to the age of ignorance. Those poets were alive when the Quran was revealed. But none of them were able to find even a minute fault in the Quran or say that they could recite anything similar to it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that the tension in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held under administrative detention, in which Israel keeps the detainees without charge for up to 6 months, a period which can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. Rights groups describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end this move.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at the illegal detentions. Israeli jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression.
The U.S. announced on January 25th that it will send 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. The tanks may take months or even years to arrive and may never see the battlefield. The M1 Abrams is the main battle tank of the U.S. military and is one of the most powerful and sophisticated tanks in the world. But for Ukraine, that is both the advantage and the problem. In his comments announcing the decision, U.S. President Joe Biden said that delivering the tanks to Ukraine will take time without further specification.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
Military analysts say it could take a year or more for all these Abrams to make it to Ukraine. So any expectations that these tanks will have an immediate impact on the fighting needs to be tempered. The tanks will be purchased from General Dynamics, the manufacturer of the tank. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said it will take many months for General Dynamics to build them. Kirby said the U.S. doesn't have the extra tanks in its arsenal, and even if there were excess tanks, it would still take many months, suggesting that the unbuilt tanks will take even longer to arrive. While the estimated timeline suggests that the tanks cannot have an immediate impact on the conflict, it seems that may never have been the intention. The decision may have been more strategic and diplomatic than military. The Biden administration made the decision against the advice of the Pentagon. The tank the U.S. really wants on the battlefields of Ukraine is the German Leopard 2. But Germany was never going to send them without the cover of the U.S. agreeing to send their tanks. In case there was any doubt, on January 19th, at the World Economic Forum, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz privately but very directly told the U.S. delegation that Germany was not going to send their tanks until the U.S. agreed to send theirs. The U.S. may never have intended the Abrams tanks for the current war. They may not even be the right tanks for this war. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley had both recommended against sending M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. In addition to how long it takes to train personnel to operate the tanks and how difficult the tanks are to maintain, they have also said that the Abrams tanks are not the right vehicles for the fight in Ukraine right now. By promising to send the tanks without ever specifying a delivery date, the U.S. may have succeeded in giving Germany and Europe cover to send their Leopard tanks without ever actually sending U.S. tanks onto the current battlefield. Most NATO members in Europe have kept open the possibility of sending their F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, even as U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would not do so. Air defense experts say U.S.-built F-16 fighter jets would offer Ukraine an edge over the Russian Air Force, but only if combined with powerful missiles and targeting information which the West would also have to provide, drawing it more actively into the war. There are clear advantages to the F-16. It is the world's most produced fighter jet, with many being decommissioned in Europe as NATO members transition to the F-35. Lockheed Martin, which produces the F-16, told the Financial Times it can increase production to replace planes sent to Ukraine. But there are practical and symbolic concerns. Experts say training Ukrainian pilots on F-16s might not be carried out in time to make a difference in the war this year. Also, bringing in Western pilots, even as privateers, could create political complications. Ukraine has reportedly prepared a batch of 50 pilots who have flown in Western military exercises and could be trained in 3 months. The symbolic concern is over losses of aircraft. Russia's development of hypersonic missiles could prove a match for the F-16, ending the narrative of NATO superiority. Perhaps for such reasons, there are still naysayers in the Western alliance. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, after bowing to pressure to send Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine, said he would not be sending the jets. The West, the US in particular, has supplied Ukraine with arms and munitions worth billions of dollars since the beginning of the war in February last year. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently doubled down on the need for new weapons from his Western backers to counter Russia's military advances, urging the West to send long-range missiles and fighter jets in addition to tanks.
We have to open the supply of long-range missiles to Ukraine, and it is important that we expand our cooperation in artillery, and we have to start supplying aircraft to Ukraine. This is our dream and our task.
Russia has frequently warned that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only prolong the war.
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial code over his tax affairs. An investigation by Sunak's ethics advisor concluded that Zahawi had broken the rules by repeatedly failing to declare an HMRC probe into his tax affairs. The dispute concluded with a £5 million settlement, including a penalty. But on Sunday, Sunak sent a letter to Zahawi saying his ethic advisor had concluded there was, quote, a serious breach of the ministerial code. In the letter, Sunak also announced his removal from the post. The dismissal came as Sunak was under fire himself for initially standing by Zahawi before ordering an internal investigation. But the Premier defended his stance, arguing that integrity in politics was the reason he did not sack the Tory chairman in time.
I think that's the right thing to do, to ensure that we have integrity in politics, but to do that in a professional way, that's what we're doing.
But many Britons remain unsatisfied with Sunak's handling of the issue. They reason out that the Prime Minister, who acted within hours over his advisor's report, should have sacked Zahawi earlier.
Well, Nadeem Zahawi obviously should be thinking about his future, but I think the bigger question here is why the Prime Minister didn't act earlier, what he knew about this situation, and why he seems to be continuously putting the interests of his party above those of his country. He knew there were allegations about Zahawi for a long time. He then knew that Zahawi had been negotiating a deal with HMRC at the same time as he was in charge of HMRC as the Chancellor. So I think the biggest question today isn't actually for Zahawi, it's actually for the Prime Minister.
Sunak also faces scrutiny over whether he knew about the minister's tax affairs and when he was told there could be a reputational risk to the government after Zahawi's appointment in October. Now many, including former high-ranking officials, suggest that Sunak's premiership risks being brought down by scandals swirling around the Tories. One such is high-stakes parliamentary inquiry into whether Sunak's predecessor Boris Johnson misled lawmakers over Partygate. We'll be right back.
The sacking of Nadeem Zahawi comes as Sunak's government, facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strike, while trailing badly in opinion polls ahead of an expected 2024 election. To many, the tax evasion of Zahawi has not come as a surprise. But for a prime minister who promised accountability, professionalism and integrity while taking office, this is just a disgrace. But what happens when governments, especially in so-called first-world countries, are submerged in corruption? Many argue that politics in those countries are too chaotic to the point where things get out of hand, like what happened in the case of Zahawi. So the ironic situation is when a man briefly in charge of the treasury does not pay taxes himself while insisting that others must pay. Apart from that, the UK is already grappling with a cost of living crisis which has been unprecedented in a century. This, coupled with the skyrocketing inflation, have so far prompted hundreds of thousands of workers from various sectors, including railway, postal, dock, energy and medical, to stage walkouts over pay and working conditions. While workers' union accuse the government of inaction and call for talks to resolve the disputes, workers want their pay in line with the inflation that is currently at the level of nearly 11%. The UK is also facing rampant food and energy costs. Some even struggle to make ends meet or even afford to put food on the table.
There's people around here who can't afford to put clothes on their kids' backs or food on their table, and that he has mistakenly missed an error.
Charities are stocking up duvets, sleeping bags, hot water bottles and blankets because they know that people can't afford to heat their homes anymore. That puts in the spotlight the number of governments which one after another took the helm at number 10 and attempted to resolve the cost of living crisis, but to no avail. The much bigger question is that how can the Sunak government run the country when it is unable to cope with this and other crises happening over there?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
on Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim, Islamati. Allah my Lord, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Choo-choo-ka-choo. It's the youth station for you. And that's right, I'm back, guys. It's me, Muzaffar Haider, and...
Yeah, and well, I'm Asma, and it's a pleasure to be here and to meet you, of course.
It's great to have you, sister. It's really good to have you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Can I advise you about something?
No, the worst advice is advice.
There you go. That's what we're discussing.
I killed it at the very beginning.
Yeah, I was trying to enter this surreptitiously, sister.
Tit for tat, you know.
Yeah, subtly. Okay, fine. So that's what why do we hate advice?
Yeah, because we don't, first thing first, we don't hate advice.
Okay.
Because sometimes when my friend or when my mom or my dad tells me, something that is going to improve the method of a thing that I'm going to do, then it's not going to be the worst advice. It's friendly. It's in a way that is my type of thing that I would love to hear. I guess it's more about the person who's giving you that advice and the way it is going to be told to you.
Why does that make such a big difference?
Because like, that's a whole story.
If somebody does it kindly and if somebody does... But then sometimes people come to you kindly.
Not even, I won't say even kindly, you know. Sometimes maybe my dad is not going to give me an advice very much kindly.
Uh-huh,
no,
uh-huh.
He's saying it to me in an authoritative way.
But it's his place.
But it's in its place, yeah.
So we don't like advice when it's coming from the wrong place.
Exactly.
Like, who are you
now that
to advise
sense.
Me? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. In some cases, maybe.
Well, it annoys me when people advise and I'm just like, well, you don't know. You'd never walked in these shoes. You don't know because you've never walked in my shoes, for example.
You have never been in my place.
Yeah. Well, why are you advising me when you don't do it yourself?
Especially if I have seen that person doing the same thing that I'm going to do, but they're just good in giving it to other people, you know? They're just good in selling it to other people.
I think one of the reasons why we don't like advice, even when it's good advice and it's coming from the right people whose place it is because we don't recognize them. So there's a hadith which says that your true friend, it's about recognizing your true friend and your fake friend.
Yeah.
Right. Differentiating between the fake friend and the true friend. Mm-hmm. So guys, if you want to differentiate between your true friends and your fake friends, remember this hadith. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, your true friend is the one who basically, he tells you your flaws.
Yeah, and he or she is your mirror.
Yeah, yeah. There's another hadith which says that the mu'minin
they reflect
are
you,
mirrors
your flaws,
of each other. Yeah, so... but this particular hadith, it says that your true friend is the one who tells you your flaws and your enemy is the one who hides your flaws from you.
Yeah. Right. But then it depends on my friend.
Not about
friend,
other people,
you know?
Just very quickly, not about other people.
Yeah.
Your true friend is also the one who hides your flaws from other people.
Exactly, yeah.
Not necessarily from you. He will advise you. He'll tell you, look, you have this flaw. I've seen you do this thing.
You
it's
know,
really
I
bad.
I would say they would look like your family.
Yeah.
I mean, if I have a flaw, they would love me to change it because they want me
there
to be
go.
In my perfect picture.
Yeah, but they're not going to tell other people.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? If they tell other
people. They're not going to use it against
me. Yeah, watch out for those guys, sister.
Yeah.
If they tell other people your flaws, they're not
then they're not friends.
They're not your friends.
They're
no.
enemies.
But if they come to you privately and they say, "Hey, sister, you've got this flaw, and I think you should address it and fix it."
Yeah,
that's your true friend. But you're not going to like it. Why? Because they're your peers.
Yes.
It's harder to take advice from your peers, right?
Yeah, that's from also another point.
Do you know what? We're going to come back to this subject right after a break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back to the studio. We've had a tea break and now we're back. So we were talking about advice and getting advice from your peers and how that's more difficult. Hearing advice from your teachers and parents is easy. Even older siblings is easier because they're older than you. Their place is different. They've got more experience. But if somebody your same age or, God forbid, younger than you advises you, it's really hard to
God forbid, younger than you.
Yeah. I mean, I get that all the time.
Really?
From all the time from like youths, and I'm just like, okay, all right, yeah, thanks for that.
I've been there and done that, so why are you giving me the advices? I should give you the advice, not you to me.
Yeah, it's really weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very weird.
But Allah wants that.
From the younger ones? To an extent,
yeah. So there's another hadith, right, where it says that you should respect those who are older than you because they've done more a'mal.
Uh-huh.
And you should respect those who are younger than you because they've committed less sins. Now, when we're looking at younger people, this is Youth Station, guys. Hey. When you're looking at those younger people, you have to realize that they haven't committed as many sins.
But, okay, they're not as experienced as I am. They're singing songs of innocence.
Look, older people might have more experience, but sometimes they've committed so many bad deeds, it's clouded their judgment. And so the advice they give you is not necessarily so pure. Whereas the young kids, sometimes they'll look up at you and it's a different kind of perspective. And they'll come to you out of a little bit more of an innocent place.
Yeah, and say, that's a nice point. But still, when we are in the situation and a younger person comes to me and tells me something, because, you know, I have logic and brain, so that process works in my brain. So I can understand that she or he are telling to me these things out of
ignorance.
Innocence or ignorance.
There's that too. Yeah. I mean, I was just giving the other side, you know.
I'm
actually quite curious now. Give me an example of where it's aggravated you.
Where it has aggravated me. Well, I have a younger brother.
Okay, now we're getting somewhere. Now I understand. Okay.
Yeah. Like, for example, that decision you're making is not true. I feel more like his mother, not his sister. Mm-hmm. So when he gives me advices, I feel like, what's happening in this world? So I'm older than you. I know more than you. Well, since I love him, I don't show any harsh reaction to what he says. I just ignore it with a smile, and it's a sarcastic smile, and then I tell him.
Okay, so you did not beat him.
No. Okay. I'm very easy.
Okay.
I'm an easy
person. Just making
clear.
All right.
No, there's no beating. I'm not cruel that much, but I will make it up for him. In another situation.
So, okay, when you smiled at him...
Sarcastically, and he would get the answer.
And he understood.
Yeah, he understood.
Okay.
So, but then, after just some days, I thought about what he said. Because, you know, as human beings, even when we reject other people, even when we reject a saying, a notion, or whatever, then we start thinking about it. And then our logic starts to make some clues out of what you have heard. And then I'm the sort of a person... who thinks about, of course, I'm not going to confess it to everyone that, okay, you were right. But then I would understand the right point and then act accordingly. But I would never confess, of course.
Right. We're going to go for a break. We'll come right back.
That's the right time, I guess.
Welcome back to the studio. We've been talking about
advice.
Giving advice, taking advice, how it's difficult to get advice from the elders and from those who are younger than us. And I just wanted to throw this out there as a reminder that, look, guys, especially you youngsters out there, if you really see a flaw in the older generation, an auntie, an uncle, an older brother, an older sister, whoever... You've got to be really delicate about the way that you give them advice.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
Really, really delicate. The famous hadith.
Yeah. Hassanain, when they met the guy who couldn't do the evolution correctly, then they show it to him through their acting. They did it in front of him.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of an indirect sort of
exactly.
teaching.
Exactly. They were indirect.
Yeah.
You can't be so straight up with the old... Because you just gave a really good example with you and your brother, how difficult it is to accept that advice, even though later on, with introspection, you understood that maybe that is the right thing to do. But you're not going to take it from some kid. You don't know anything, right? You kids don't know Jack. Yeah.
But I have to say it as well that even the kids nowadays can teach you things. So we have to change this cliche sort of notion that says you can't take it from the younger ones. Mm-hmm. But still, we could have some perspective from their own point of views because that could work, you know? Just as I was talking about the relationship between me and my brother, then many times I see... The things that he talks about are just horizons that I cannot see.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess since there is this gap, even now when there is 10 years of, gap between you and your siblings or, I don't know, your friends or whomever, even that 10 years is going to make a lot of change in the way you look at life.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess they also can teach you things or give you another perspective, another horizon, show you the other side of the story.
Allah just wants our eyes and our minds, our hearts to be open so that we can accept that advice which is coming our way.
So we should actually take the good things.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't look at their age or at their personality or whatever. Just take the good advices from every single person.
Yes. And reject not necessarily bad advice, but even good advice, which is not for you.
Yeah.
Right? If you go to a different person, they're gonna give you advice from their own perspective.
Yeah.
What you really have to try and do is obey only and only Allah.
As even our holy book is telling us that we have to listen to the best ideas and then catch the best thing that is going to benefit us, we have to do it. And I guess it's not that very much difficult because as time goes by, as we grow older, we just understand the people that used to give us advice, they were just so much... loving us, actually, and they were just expressing their love towards us because as we grow older and we see the youngsters who are so much dear to us and we see that they're doing something wrong, we very much desire to show them the way and tell them that this way is not going to lead you somewhere good. So just in this way, we understand that sometimes those who give you the advice are just in love with you and they're mere... Desire is just to show you the true way.
Right you are, sister. And the verse that you mentioned is this. الَّذِينَ يَسْتَمِعُونَ الْقَوْلَ فَيَتَّبِعُونَ أَحْسَنَهُ. Those who listen to speech and follow the best of it. أُولَٰئِكَ الَّذِينَ حَدَاهُمُ اللَّهُ. Those are they who Allah has guided. So I think that's a really, really good point right there, that you should listen to it. But don't follow all of it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Listen to all of it, but don't follow all of it.
Pick the parts that are more suitable for you.
Yeah, and again, don't look at where the advice is coming from necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But we are coming to the end of the episode, sister. We need to quickly address the fact that you shouldn't listen to advice coming from everywhere.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to listen to the advice of Shaitan.
Exactly, that's another point.
And he swears, I am to you... A sincere advisor.
Yeah, he just sneaks around and he's waiting for a situation. So sometimes even a friend can give me an advice that would lead me to hell.
But then to you, it's going to seem like good advice.
Exactly.
So where should you listen to advice? Where is it coming from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a hadith from, I don't want to refute everything that we've just said, but there's a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam where he says, I'd rather listen to the advice of an elderly man than a brazen, young, brash youth.
Wow, yeah.
Right? Because it does make sense. They have more experience. Mm-hmm. They have more understanding.
Logic is more improved.
Ahsant, right? So true. But yeah, they've got more experience. I'd put it down to experience.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's pretty much relatable because as we get older, I just said it before, we understand what happens when you get old and you just give advice to other people. You do it out of sheer love for the other people. You don't want them to get entrapped
Well, that's all we have time for today, sister. It's been a pleasure discussing this stuff with you.
Of course, of course.
We'll see you next time, inshallah.
Inshallah. So, until another session, I bid you...